From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn how Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin is shifting its work to meet the needs of its patients. Then look at the first annual Ho-Chunk Canoe Journey and learn why celebrating the culture and the language are essential to preserving Native history.
It's really important to keep that alive because a lot of the traditions that we have and things that we value as Ho-Chunks have the potential to get lost. So, you know, we have to keep making the effort to learn.
We'll learn about five community events happening this month in Milwaukee, then chat with Judge Derek Mosley about his new snack pick and a new place to find a good book.
You walk in and you see these books and the people in the books look like you, and you see them as doctors, as lawyers, as accountants. And it makes you realize that you can do all of these things.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. After nearly 50 years, abortion is seemingly illegal in the state of Wisconsin due to an 1849 law that makes all abortions illegal, except those deemed necessary to save the life of the mother. But Lake Effect has already spoken with a couple experts who say that exemption is vague and likely to lead to the deaths of pregnant women experiencing medical emergencies. This is a stark change in the rights of pregnant people and concerning for physicians like Dr. Kathy King. She's the medical director of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin and has spent the week working toward getting her license in Illinois to continue helping Wisconsin women access health care. She joins me now. Dr. King, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Well, thank you, Joy, for the opportunity to speak with you today about this important issue.
This is a kind of big question because I'm going to guess there's a variety of answers, but how did your life change the moment that Roe v. Wade was overturned?
So I've been an OBGYN for 25 years, and I've been incorporating provision of abortion into that reproductive care that I've provided the entire time. So last Friday, I was at Planned Parenthood, and we had really tried to book as many patients as we could because we anticipated that the ruling was going to come on a Monday. So we had really packed our schedules for Friday and Saturday. And we tried to see as many patients as we could on Friday. But as you know, the ruling came early. And I'll never forget, shortly after 9 a.m., one of my staff members just shouted out, "It's done. It's done. We have to stop." And in that moment, I think my staff, our patients, everyone just froze, facing the enormity of what had just happened. That 49 years of federal protection for access to abortion was instantly eliminated. And because of the uncertainty of whether our 173-year-old Wisconsin abortion ban had taken effect, we just had to stop. You know, and that day I just walked around the clinic, seeing the empty offices, our empty waiting room, our empty procedure rooms. And really just kind of started, like many people, to grieve the loss of what we had taken for granted, the access to safe legal abortion in Wisconsin and across the country. So I'm no longer providing abortions in Wisconsin. I am hoping that this is just a pause, that there's a legal path forward. I have, and many others have, worked on getting licensure in Illinois and plan to travel to Illinois to increase their capacity, since many, many people will be accessing abortion care in Illinois because they can't access that care in surrounding states.
What are your concerns right now for the people of Wisconsin who need this kind of care?
First and foremost, I'm concerned about the health and well-being of pregnant person seeking abortion or faced with pregnancy complications whose care will be delayed, denied, or compromised. Although abortion is incredibly safe, you know, we now have laws that are going to make abortion illegal or nearly illegal in 26 states, which will delay access to care and hence increase risks. As it's been historically, you know, individuals of means will be able to access care, but many people are going to be forced to continue a pregnancy against their will. Patients who seek abortion already have faced barriers to accessing that care, as well as facing significant health disparities and health inequities that are just going to be magnified by this lack of access. And, you know, it's really the most vulnerable people that are going to be most impacted by this. So, you know, the majority of our patients live in poverty and may not be able to, you know, afford traveling out of state or missing work or paying for childcare and won't be able to access the care that they need. We know that people of color disproportionately have higher health risks associated with pregnancy. You know, in Wisconsin, if you are Black, your risk of maternal mortality is 5 times higher than if you are white. And so that disparity will probably be magnified without timely access to abortion in Wisconsin. You know, the other thing that really worries me in Wisconsin is the criminal abortion ban's only exception is to save the life of the mother. And I fear that physicians wary of criminal prosecution may delay intervention. You know, in certain circumstances, a common one is when water breaks in a pre-viable point in pregnancy, and there's a severe threat of sepsis or hemorrhage that could risk the person's death. We know from well-documented cases in Ireland and Poland that if people's care is delayed or compromised, the people die. So we're kind of in this space where people are trying to figure out how to comply with a law from 1849 that literally is so brief that it just is telling us the only exception to abortion is one performed by a physician and is necessary to save the life of the mother. And so, you know, the question is, what does that mean? How dire does someone's health need to be able to legally perform an abortion in Wisconsin? That physicians may have to choose between essentially committing medical malpractice and not intervening when they should have, when someone's physical health is at risk, versus facing criminal prosecution and 6 to 10 years in jail if they are deemed to have intervened too soon. And so it's just, we're at this point where medical care is really at risk of being compromised because of people's fear of criminal prosecution. And I'm concerned of what the future holds. We already have anti-abortion advocates and people running for elected office in this state who say they even want to remove the life of the mother exemption from Wisconsin law. So by their logic, if a physician performs a life-saving abortion at 17 weeks on a patient whose water broke and now they're septic, that physician will face criminal charges and imprisonment. I mean, the direction of where this is all going is frightening and ludicrous.
It sounds like there's going to be a lot of dead people.
Yes.
Now, you've been in Illinois, as you mentioned, you've been training down there. Is that part of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin's shifting focus here, shifting how it cares for patients?
Yes. So, you know, Planned Parenthood and really abortion providers across the country have been preparing for the overturning of Roe. You know, the SCOTUS decision was shocking, but not really surprising to those of us who've been paying attention to the degradation of reproductive rights in this country for the past 40 years. Once the decision came down, when we could no longer provide actual abortions to our patients, Planned Parenthood staff, other abortion providing staff really across the country had to pivot. And when you do this work, first and foremost, you really are there to help the patients access the care that they need. So, you know, on the day of decision, our staff did what they do. They showed our patients care, compassion, and dignity, and they pivoted to try to let people know, okay, here are your options. Here is where you can access care. Here is what we can do to try and help you afford the expense of traveling to where you need to travel. In the Midwest, Illinois is going to be the primary haven state where people will be able to access care. For those in northern Wisconsin, they will likely travel to Minnesota. And Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin has been collaborating with Planned Parenthood of Illinois for a while now, just to prepare for this moment. As I said, physicians and other licensed staff have gotten licensure in Illinois, are in the process of doing so. Our staff, again, this week, traveled to Illinois to train, to be able to step in to help them improve capacity. You know, we can do everything in Wisconsin other than provide the actual abortion. So we will be there for people, you know, to assess their early pregnancy, to provide an ultrasound, lab work if needed, to help them navigate to where they can access care and help with financial assistance so that they can afford to get the care that they need and deserve. And then we can be there for them afterward if they need follow-up care, contraception, or other family planning services.
Are there plans to make more healthcare centers at the border, specifically the border of Illinois and Wisconsin?
Yes, I mean, that is certainly being looked at. The one uncertainty is the uncertain legal landscape we have. So we don't really know if this is going to be a short pause or a very long pause or no pause at all, that we'll have to live with this law for a very long time. Planned Parenthood of Illinois had the foresight to establish a health center in Waukegan. And out of that center, primarily they have been doing family planning, but plan to ramp up providing abortion services at that site. And that's where the staff from Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin will be filling in to provide that care. As well, there are other sites in the northern part of Illinois that are being looked at to set up health centers to be able to help those from other parts, the more western part of Wisconsin or even Iowa, to access that care.
All right. Well, Dr. King, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing your work.
Thank you, Joy. It was really an honor and privilege to be able to speak to you today. So thank you so much for your interest in this.
Dr. Kathy King is an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology and the medical director of Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. At WUWM.com, you can find all of our coverage on abortion and reproductive rights in Wisconsin, including a conversation with the Wisconsin Medical Society about the confusion many physicians are dealing with in light of this ruling. An unusual fleet journeyed down Wisconsin waterways last week, starting in Madison and ending 40 nautical miles away in the Rock River in Beloit. The fleet was made up of hand-hewn dugout canoes, fashioned after those used by long-ago ancestors of the Ho-Chunk Nation. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bent spoke with several people who were part of the first annual Ho-Chunk canoe journey. Arvina Martin is a Madison politician, Cloris Lowe is an artist and lecturer at UW-Madison, and Demetria Abangan Brown-Eagle is a student who participated in the journey. They're all members of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and the conversation starts with Martin explaining the inspiration for this new annual event.
Our cultural and heritage preservation office had wanted to do this after the ancient dugout canoe was found last year. And so planned to do this, especially for the youth across Wisconsin. And we got Miss Demetria Abangan, who came in all the way from Oklahoma. And we also had relatives from the Nebraska Winnebago tribe come out to participate with us.
Who dug out the canoe? Who created the canoe itself?
There were a number of times where they took it around to different community centers to try to have both youth and adults participate in the project. However, with, you know, all the restrictions with COVID and everything, and just trying to keep people safe, those events were abbreviated a little bit.
Cloris, did you do most of the paddle from beginning to end?
I was not in the dugout. I was just in a kayak off to the side. We wanted to get as many people in and out of the canoe as we could during the week-long paddle trip. I participated on the first day and then the last 2 days. So I wasn't there for the entire trip. However, I think, Demi, you were, correct?
Yeah.
That's incredible. What did it feel like when you first climbed into that boat?
I'm really excited. And I was like, yes, first one in.
Had you ever paddled before?
In a canoe once. It was at Disney World and my dad fell in because the canoe just tipped and he fell over into the water. It wasn't deep, luckily, but that's probably why my sister didn't want to come. And there were also crocodiles in the water. So
how did you happen to come?
I took Ho-Chunk classes online, like informative classes on like plants that they used to eat and foods and stuff like that. Bill Quackenbush, he talked about this dugout canoe that they were working on. He filled us in every single class that we had.
So along the way, you stopped at places that were significant to the Ho-Chunk Nation. Is that right, Demetria?
Yeah. We stopped at the spot where they found the really old dugout canoe. And they were telling the story about how they found it. And I was just like, wow, that's so amazing.
You had to be really proud of Avina. Yeah. So tell me about your journey. Were you raised with the tradition and some of the language, or what has the arc of your life experience been, and how does this paddle fit into it?
You know, I grew up going to go visit my Gaga, who lived in Sand Pillow up by Black River Falls. We used to go up. I mean, it felt like every weekend, and we would go stay with her. I was exposed to language, but didn't understand because back in our grandparents' generation, they were told not to speak English. A lot of them went to boarding schools, and a lot of them really believed that their family's successes were going to be based on how their children, you know, interact in a community larger than our Ho-Chunk community, and we're not taught language. When I was a kid, that was what people spoke when they didn't want the kids to understand or know what was going on. So it wasn't until, you know, the last few years that I've been able to kind of start learning language. Unfortunately, in fits and spurts, it's a challenging language to learn if you only speak English. Grammar and the structure of the language are not similar to English in a lot of ways, but it's, you know, really important that we continue to learn and teach our kids, grandkids, et cetera, because languages are important to know how it's almost kind of like a part of a values, and it, you can tell a lot about a culture based on the language. And it's really important to keep that alive because a lot of the traditions that we have and things that we value as Ho-Chunks have the potential to get lost if we don't continue it. So, you know, we have to keep making the effort to learn. And this was really exciting for me. I was an elder when they found the dugout canoe and was invited to go see them raise it, but had to work at another job that during that time, and I was really, really disappointed to have missed it. So I was very excited to participate in this experience. As Demi mentioned, we got to go see the spot where they found it. I live over by, you know, on the west side of Madison, and I had a moment when we were in the boat that this is where it was found. And this is where over 1,000 years ago, our ancestors were. And I live on the west side, like within a couple of miles, you know, I could walk there right now and get there. And that ended up being a really powerful and like very overwhelming feeling that I didn't anticipate, seeing how close it was to my house and to where I grew up. It was just really powerful. And I still haven't quite found the words to describe how profound that was. And I know that I kind of felt when I had that moment of realization, despite knowing logically that this is true, like just being there really set off a lot of emotions that I had not anticipated on having. And it almost took my breath away thinking about it.
Cloris, you're an artist. You teach Ho-Chunk, right? What has your journey been?
Actually, with the language, I did not get started until very recently. I was lucky enough to be accepted into a program that the Ho-Chunk Nation used to have within their language division, an apprenticeship program. And that apprenticeship program was set up to teach individuals who were very interested in learning the language in hopes that they would then go out and continue teaching it. I'm still out there trying to teach it and have been lucky enough to gain some acquaintances and connections at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so last semester, we did our first real sort of on the books Ho-Chunk language class, and that went really well. And so that's what started up this past semester, and will be continuing in the semesters to come, hopefully. But as I was saying, yeah, I actually did not start learning the language until 2015. That program is where they pair you up with an elder, and you're supposed to spend all day with that elder, just participating in everyday activities, learning the language that way. I was lucky enough to be paired with my grandfather, so it was a wonderful experience. My grandfather is one of the first language speakers. It's if you are born with the language and then you learn English as your second language. So Ho-Chunk is my grandfather's first language. And then he was also a member of that boarding school generation, one of the last members of that generation. He came back to the language as well, probably about 25 or 30 years ago, because he realized how important it was to try to carry it on. Because even though he knew the language, he did not teach his children the language. And so it was not passed on. So in that sense, sadly, those boarding schools and try to eradicate the language worked pretty well. And so the Ho-Chunk Nation has made efforts into trying to reverse that. And that's where we are today. And I think some of the online resources that have been developed by the language division are an amazing asset for people to be able to access now that were not around even 3 years ago or 2 years ago. COVID sort of forced that information to have to be put into an accessible digital format, not just for the members of our nation, but for anybody who's really interested.
Arvina and Demetria talked about the experience of seeing where that ancient dugout canoe was lifted from the depths of the water. Is there another moment or part of the trip that sticks out to you in terms of, you know, how it resonated with you or how you saw it resonating with others?
I mean, I think the entire trip in general was just a wonderful experience. I have a hard time putting maybe one specific spot or taking one specific spot out of my mind and saying, oh, this was sort of the most important part of the journey. Because yeah, it was just the fact that we had interest in this project and people showing up along the way, different individuals showing up each day, those that either knew about it or people that were just curious about it. I know on the last day, we had a few individuals show up to do just a couple miles of paddle. And it was wonderful to have them just asking questions about the Ho-Chunk Nation and just Native Americans in general, and just trying to, you know, educate people and maybe clear up some misinformation or, yeah, just curiosities.
Do you think that this experience will influence your art?
Oh, I believe it will, yes. And that was, I was interested in just the trip in general, regular curiosity, but also, you know, there was that part inside of me that was, yeah, I was hoping to gain something from it in order to be able to eventually put it into a piece or have it inform a piece somehow. A lot of my work does have a Native American sort of portion of it, but it's not something that I try to do explicitly. It is something that's kind of more done for me. And if that shows through, then that's fine. But I'm not trying to push any Native American agenda on anybody or Ho-Chunk mindset on anyone. However, like I said, I can see those things in the pieces once in a while. And, you know, if you are Ho-Chunk or Native American, maybe you're able to see those things as well within it. But no, I'm not trying to like bash anybody over the head with any sort of influence to make you think a certain way. The whole trip is a bit of a piece in itself, right? Trying to get people involved, both Ho-Chunk community and non-Ho-Chunk community members, and just like activate people into realizing that we are still here and not just a thing of the past. Even though we were, you know, referencing the past with the dugout canoe, but also being able to show that we are still in these areas and in these communities.
Arvina, you're smiling. What are you thinking?
I think that this was part of this larger piece of reclamation of our culture. The only canoes I've ever paddled in have been ones, you know, from hoofers or something like that. And to do this in our way, to kind of bring that back and experience something that our ancestors did. As someone who works in politics, I kind of take the other side of the view in that, you know, our mere existence is political. The government has tried throughout various and in various different ways over the years, over the centuries, tried to eliminate us, and we're still here. And to me, an event like this is a powerful statement, both inwards for ourselves, that we're still here and that we care about our culture and our origins and those that came before us.
Dimitri, I heard you say in one of your interviews, you are a proud Ho-Chunk Nation member. What does that mean to you? Why is that so important?
I mean, this is kind of what I've been telling everybody, but I'm telling this to everybody because it's true. I mean, I feel like being Ho-Chunk is like special, and it makes me feel special.
Arvina Martin is a Madison politician, Cloris Lowe is an artist and lecturer at UW-Madison, and Demetria Abangan-Brown-Eagle is a student who participated in the journey. They're all members of the Ho-Chunk Nation, and they spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. And in case you didn't know, you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast. If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Coming up, Judge Derek Mosley will share a favorite local snack and tell us about a new place to buy a good book. But first, we'll look at five community events happening this month in the city of Milwaukee. That's coming up next, right here on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. July is a great time to be in Milwaukee. There's so much to do and so many ways to enjoy the great weather while getting to better know your neighborhood. Every month, Sam Woods from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service shares with us some of the many events happening in the city. Sam, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Joy, it is a pleasure.
So the first thing we're going to look at, I think, is something a lot of people are probably interested in at the moment. It is a healing space initiative of sorts and a specific part of their work.
Yeah. So the Healing Space Initiative is a initiative from the city government to take city-owned vacant lots and turn them into relaxing, ADA-accessible parks or green spaces. So these often have, you know, birdhouses, little free libraries, benches, places to sit, just kind of a place to relax and be in community with one another, and be outdoors. And this kind of came from the pandemic where everyone was kind of isolated inside. This last year, it was only available to in the Harambe neighborhood, and now they're kind of spreading out to different aldermanic districts. This month, there's a couple what they call visioning sessions for these healing space initiatives. So if you're if you live, especially if you live in the Metcalf Park neighborhood or the Harambe neighborhood, they're looking for your input as to what you would like to see in these spaces. And so the first visioning session on July 6th is led by the Metcalf Park Community Bridges organization. The next one on July 8th, it will be led by Northcott Neighborhood House.
All right, a great way to get involved in your community. One of the ways a lot of people like to get out into Milwaukee, mm-hmm. get into their own communities, is through music during the summer. It's a great time to see live music. And this is an event I don't actually know about.
Yeah, so Music Under the Stars is a periodic music concert series usually featuring local emerging musicians organized by Arts at Large. And Arts at Large is a arts nonprofit mostly focused on nurturing kind of young artists and creative workers, often like high school age, middle school age, through young adulthood and kind of giving them resources to kind of explore their craft and become who they want to become as artists. And part of what they do, again, is put it on this music concert series called Music Under the Stars. And I want to shout out one coming up this month in particular featuring local artist John Stanford. And so John is a wonderfully gifted neo-soul R&B kind of singer. He also plays piano. I've been to a few of his shows, and trust me when I say between his singing and the jokes he'll crack between songs and kind of the interaction between the audience, you'll be smiling the whole time and you'll leave feeling refreshed and a little lighter. And so that's on July 8th at Pagliafito Eco Arts Park, and that's at the corner of 3rd and Walker Streets in Walker's Point. Now, if you can't make this particular show, don't worry, because a crowd favorite, the Washington Park Wednesdays concert series, is back this year. And kind of on a personal note, I'm a little saddened. I lived in Washington Park, and one of the big things that I was looking forward to when moving there was I could just walk down to Washington Park Wednesdays. But unfortunately, the two summers I was there was summer 2020 and summer 2021. And so that's a little bit of a bummer for me. So I will make sure, certainly, to make it to one of these concerts starting in July. They start July 13th and then continue, of course, every Wednesday afterwards.
All right. So for people who are still in the Washington Park, Washington Heights area, an old favorite that is returning.
Absolutely.
Now, looking at some of the other ways we can engage with the arts over the summer, there is a group that I'm not familiar with, mm-hmm. but for some reason, in my brain, they're a children's group, even though they're probably not. Fanana Banana just reminds me of, like, a toy?
Yeah, I think that might be a little misleading, but yeah. they're not, you know, it's not. So the event that I'm going to talk about, children are definitely encouraged to attend. But other than that, I'm not sure how much of it's a youth group. So Fanana Banana is an art collective that aims to support Muslim, Middle Eastern, and North African artists in Milwaukee through events and just kind of general support. And this is not a new art collective. If I remember correctly, they were formed in 2019 or sometime slightly before the pandemic began. But this will be their first art show. It's entitled We Are MKE. It'll also be on July 8th on Mitchell Street in the big building that says the Kunzelman Esser Lofts. I don't know if anyone has been kind of driving down Mitchell Street. It's a big sign. It's really hard to miss. It's in that building, kind of on the ground floor. The event will include artwork, art vendors, free food, music performance, and yes, interactive art for the kids. So you're not all the way wrong with Fanana Banana being kind of kid oriented or kid friendly, but it's definitely a lot more to it than that.
The next event I especially think of as being a kind of kid thing. Mm-hmm. We certainly had a lot of movie nights when I was a child. But this is a movie night at a special location. If you haven't been, you should go. Wisconsin Black Historical Society.
Yeah. And so before I plug the event, I'll just feed off what you were saying about the Wisconsin Black Historical Society. It's a beautiful space. Again, if you haven't been, I would say make an effort to go, even if not for the movie night. Just go and see the museum and see the event space that is there. And if you happen to run into Claiborne Benson III, strike up a conversation and ask him about his genealogy work. I'll just kind of leave it at that. But he's really into that stuff, and he will talk your ear off and in a good way. And just has stories and stories and stories about the work he's done through genealogy and history, and just really interesting guy. But this movie night that I wanted to plug on July 21st at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society, the movie will be King Richard. It's the story of how Venus and Serena Williams' father kind of, I guess, like engineered the success of his now famous daughters from the tennis courts of Compton, California, to all the way to Wimbledon and all the success that you're probably aware of if you're listening to this. To your point, it's a family-friendly event, a beautiful space, and a cool event. Come out and meet your neighbors.
Now, the final event is something that is happening in conjunction with a big Milwaukee tradition, Bastille Days, but this is not Bastille Days on the east side, which we're also familiar with. It is Bastille Days West.
Yes. So Bastille Days West is, this is the first time this has ever happened. And it's the first time, to my knowledge, that Bastille Days has taken place anywhere other than the other location. It's at the east side location. It's at Cathedral Square. But this one is happening on the west side, on Vliet Street between 57th and 60th Streets, just on July 14th. So whereas Bastille Days East will have, the events that it usually has over a whole weekend, this one's just on that July 14th. But they'll close down Vliet Street between that 57th and 60th Streets for a French fashion show, a French film festival, a bike ride with berets, and a cafe with wine and beignets, and a bunch of other like French-themed events and things to do, music. So if you're a fan of Bastille Days East, but maybe, for whatever reason, you don't want to make the drive, or you just want to see something new, or you want to see Bastille Days West, and then the next day, compare it to Bastille Days East, make the trip. Should be interesting.
All right. Well, a lot to do this July. Sam, thank you, as always, for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sam Woods is a staff reporter at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. And every month, he joins us to talk about some of the events happening in the city. It's time now for our Monthly with Mosley conversation. Judge Derek Mosley joins Lake Effect every month to share restaurant recommendations, unpack our legal system, and share his personal research on Black history. Judge Derek Mosley is a municipal court judge for the city of Milwaukee, and he's also known as one of Milwaukee's food influencers. He joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang with a snack pick and a recommendation on where to stop for a new book in Milwaukee.
This month, we got a couple of local picks that you got for the month of July. Let's start off with the food pick that you got. I see you brought your little bag of snacks too. You ate half of the bag already. What'd you bring today?
Oh, Mallory, why are you outing me on the radio? But yes, so I brought one of my most favorite snacks here, made here in the city of Milwaukee. It's called Emmanuel's Mix, and Emmanuel's Mix is sort of like Chex Mix, but good, right? And so Emmanuel's Mix is a mixture of pretzels and Chex Mix and pecans, and it has different seasonings on them. So it's a perfect combination of salty and sweet. And I kid you not, Mallory, the reason why I only have half a bag left is I'm just going to take one bite, just one bite. And next thing I know, I look down and half the bag's left. It's great. And I have them and they don't last very long in my house, but it's made here in Milwaukee. It's a Black woman who makes it. So a Black woman owned company that makes Emmanuel snack mix.
What's your favorite flavor of the snack mix? Are there different flavors?
No, there's only one flavor. And she's keeps that secret, how she makes it, she keeps a secret. I know all the things that are in it, but when I put those things in a bowl, they don't taste this good. And it's just, like I said, it's salty, it's sweet, you get hints of vanilla, and it's crunchy, and it's just, it is the perfect snack mix.
Where can you pick up a pack?
Yeah, so fortunately, it's summer, and so farmers markets are a big spot for the mix. So you can find it at the Deer District Market. You can find it at the Brewery Market. You can find it at the Fondy Food Market. It'll be at the Milwaukee Night Market that takes place downtown. But I always get mine at Kuchi Chocolia, the producers cooperative over at Sherman Phoenix. And so when you go into Sherman Phoenix, you go into the little safe back there because it used to be an old bank, and you go into the safe and there's bags of it sitting there being sold. And I'm telling you, it is fantastic.
That's noted. That's going to be on my grocery list now.
You will not be disappointed, Mallory.
So the next recommendation for this month on the list is actually a place to visit, to hang out at. But Judge Mosley, what is your second recommendation for this month for people to check out?
So my second recommendation means a lot to me because it's something that I, as a kid, did not have. And so I'm just so happy that we have now this place for young kids. And so the place is called Rooted MKE. It's a BIPOC bookstore. And so it specializes in Black, Indigenous, and people of color as the lead characters in children's books. It's everything from fantasy to fiction to even history. There's little books about Black history for children, written for children. But it's more than just that. It's also a maker space. So there's a lot of classes that are held there. So you can go there with your children and do a class and learn how to, whether it's crafts. Right now, they're specializing in summer reading. And so they want to make sure that, you know, you have that gap over the summer when kids get out of school and before they come back, that summer gap where they kind of forget, they don't do a whole lot of reading and they forget a lot of things that they learned. And so Rooted Milwaukee is trying to get those kids back in. Come on in, let's do some reading. And they sit around and it's parents and kids and they read together and then they discuss what they just read. And it's fantastic. Not to mention the makers part where you get to create things and crafts, but it's something that when I said it was something that we didn't have when I grew up, was when you see open a book and the characters in the book look like you. And that just means so much because you feel like you are part of the story where your heroes look like you, right? And it's not just for, you know, people of color. It's important that everybody goes to Rooted and buys books for their children so that their children can see that all the characters, lead characters, don't have to be white. They can be Indigenous, they could be Latino, they could be Asian, they could be Black, they could be all of the people who make up this great country. And so I just get goosebumps when I walk in there, just because it is the perfect place for young people to learn and to become better readers and to learn more about history and just to fantasize, right?
Did you get to pick up any books when you were at Rooted MKE?
So I did not get a chance to pick up any books yet because I want to actually come in and I want to help with the reading. So I love to read. And so I want to spread that love of reading to other people. And just to show how important it is to see yourself in things. When I was growing up, I had never seen a Black lawyer in my entire life. Never saw one. Didn't even know they existed. And I remember I turned on the TV one day and there was a TV show that was called LA Law. And in the show LA Law, there was a young Black lawyer. It was played by the actor Blair Underwood. And when I saw him, he was the first Black lawyer I ever saw. And from that moment on, I was like, I want to be a lawyer. And so that's what Rooted does, right? You walk in and you see these books and the people in the books look like you and you see them as doctors, as lawyers, as accountants, you know, as engineers. And it makes you realize that you can do all of these things. It's a nurturing place. As soon as you walk in, you feel comfortable, right? And so kids feel comfortable, adults feel comfortable. And I just want to make sure everybody gets an opportunity to experience that location because it is something unique here in Milwaukee.
Judge Mosley, thank you so much for your snack picks with Emmanuel's mix. And I will definitely be returning back to Rooted MKE in the near future. So thank you again for being here on Lake Effect for Monthly with Mosley. I'll see you next month.
Mallory, thank you. It's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Judge Derek Mosley is a municipal court judge for the city of Milwaukee. And he's known as one of Milwaukee's food influencers. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. You can listen to past Monthly with Mosley segments at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll get a summer book recommendation from the Milwaukee Public Library. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Every month here on Lake Effect, we partner with the Milwaukee Public Library for our Book of the Month series to bring you a new reading recommendation. For July's Book of the Month, we'll learn a bit of American history. Connor Bowman is a librarian in the Special Collections and Archives Department. He recommends reading Michael Hines' A Worthy Piece of Work, The Untold Story of Madeline Morgan, and the Fight for Black History in Schools. Bowman joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to share more about this book.
Connor, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect. I'm really excited to chat today about your book pick.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled.
So it is July, and around this time of year, the country is celebrating Independence Day with fireworks or maybe even a barbecue or a gathering or even learning a bit about American history. And Connor, today your book recommendation focuses on a World War II era teacher and activist named Madeline Morgan who fought to get Black history taught in Chicago schools. Tell me a little bit more about this piece of American history. Why did you pick this read?
My book today is called A Worthy Piece of Work, The Untold Story of Madeline Morgan and the Fight for Black History in Schools by Michael Hines. And I chose this book because it's a history book about American history. This book highlights Black women educators and their role in building Black history curriculum in schools. And in Madeline Morgan's case, she was an educator in the Chicago Public Schools. So Madeline Morgan wrote the supplemental units for the course of instruction in social studies. And that was a curriculum that highlighted Black history that was published in May 28th, 1942. And during that time, there was European fascism going on in the 1930s and 40s. And the United States wanted to distance themselves from the fascism that was going on. So they were interested in uniting the country, which meant embracing intercultural understanding. There was also a big rise in the Black history movement, and that was led by Carter G. Woodson. And this was Black educators and Black leaders writing Black history to get into schools. And Madeline Morgan came in on those two fronts and wrote the supplementary units for the course of education in social studies. And she became a huge success, and it was implemented into the Chicago Public Schools. And she was a national and international star educator.
What generally was the reception to Madeline Morgan's supplemental units about Black history in Chicago schools? And what was the national impact of that?
Michael Hines says that it was a very successful but short-lived success because there was more racial tension post-war. And so while it was a huge success, it kind of died off early, which is why Michael Hines wanted to write this story to again highlight Madeline Morgan's efforts in writing this curriculum and how much of a success this was. And for me, it kind of highlights the importance of questioning that dominant history that we're kind of presented with in schools, maybe in our education, and look for different perspectives and look for different voices. We tend to think that maybe history might be, along with other subjects, there's like a right answer and a wrong answer. And I think with history, it's just so complicated and there's a lot of voices that we need to listen to. It's important to get a lot of different perspectives and just know that history is complicated.
Were there any moments when you were reading the book that really stuck with you, like any passages or any pieces of history that really stuck with you?
I think what stuck out with me most is the community that Madeline Morgan was in. She was a part of the Phi Delta Kappa sorority. She got a lot of help from her colleagues at the Chicago Public Schools. She was a frequent at the Chicago Public Library, more specifically, the George Cleveland Hall branch. And that was a branch that is really well known for its Black history. And there was a big community of women, Black women specifically, with her to support her writing this supplementary unit and to get it into the Chicago public schools.
Yeah, and that's all really important. And I definitely think that she is a key part of American history. And she was a Chicago-based teacher and activist. And of course, we have local history here as well that we can definitely learn more about in Milwaukee and the Southeast Wisconsin area. And so, Connor, how can we learn more about our own local history through the Milwaukee Public Library?
At the Milwaukee Public Library, in the Zeidler Local History Room, we have a lot of different resources and special collections that highlight our local history. And more specifically, we have a collection called the Irene Bishop Goggins Collection. And Irene Bishop Goggins collected a bunch of newspaper clippings, photographs, publications, and she was definitely a local historian and collector of a lot of Milwaukee's Black history. And we are very fortunate to have this collection. It's 34 boxes of materials from 1930 all the way up till 2017. She received an honorary doctorate at UWM History Department. And I think it's really cool too that we have that collection and that patrons can ask for the materials from that.
Connor Bowman is a librarian in the Special Collections and Archives Department with the Milwaukee Public Library. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, in light of the lifeguard shortage at Milwaukee County beaches, we'll chat with the beach ambassadors who are helping folks stay safe near Lake Michigan. Plus, learn about the man behind the River West Food Pantry. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.